Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by American Public Media. Well, today we go back to the golden age of Arab cuisine, the medieval period, and for my money, a time of seductive cooking. Our guest is Charles Perry, historian of Arab cuisines and author of the foreword to a book called Medieval Cuisine of the Arab World. Baking authority Dory Greenspan reveals a Parisian obsession, the Paris macaroon. We are turning the tables on me once again. I'm the one getting interviewed for round two of our Back to the Table series. This time it's the art of the stir fry. Then making your own wine vinegar, or how to turn that little bit of leftover cab into pure gold. And as always in the second half of the show, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. You can get to us at 800-537-5252. So let's roll with Jane and Michael Stern, brought to you by Las Vegas. Vegas Uncorked brings chefs from around the world to town this May. More at vegasuncorked.com. Jane and Michael Stern write the road food column in Gourmet magazine.
You know, Lynn, if you want to turn me off to a restaurant, tell me it's cute. I mean, those are kind of words doom. However, here's the exception that proves the rule or disproves the rule. Place in Mystic, Connecticut called Kitchen Little. The whole place is 400 square feet. It's primarily breakfast, known for their linguica, sausage, and kind of Portuguese-American breakfast. The cutest little place you have ever seen in your life.
What does it look like inside?
It's very, very, very crowded. There's a short counter, a very short counter, where you look in on a kind of semi-open kitchen. And then there are actually quite a number of tables for two. But the thing is that these tables for two are so close together that unless you're watching where your fork goes, it's very possible that you're going to fork up your neighbor's linguica sausage rather than your own.
And it's right on the water in Mystic with a grassy shoreline that goes, you know, from kitchen. I always want to say Chicken Little, Kitchen Little, down to the water. It's truly the kind of restaurant where everybody knows everybody. I mean, part of it is because you're sort of sitting in everyone's lap, but it's a place where regulars go, and it's like being in somebody's kitchen. It's just wonderful.
Is this a Portuguese area? I mean, there are a lot of Portuguese immigrants there?
I think what we could say is that there's a certain amount of Portuguese influence on the menu, but I believe the people who run it are not Portuguese. You get the linguica sausage, which is typical. A breakfast sandwich is always available on a Portuguese roll as opposed to a Kaiser
roll.
What's
a Portuguese roll?
Oh, it's very good. It's kind of, how to describe it? It's similar to a hard roll.
It's sweet. It's
slightly,
kind of a sweet dough.
Slightly
not like
sweet.
A Danish sweet, but just a little sweet.
Kind of
and
chewy.
Eggy.
I don't think it's eggy.
Really? To me, it tastes
eggy. All right,
eggy.
All right. We can debate that. But it's kind of chewy, and it's got a crust that isn't crisp at all, but it's kind of a sort of a, almost, I don't want to say leathery because that's a bad word, but it's got the real substance to the crust, which makes it an ideal roll for a bacon, egg, and cheese sandwich.
You know, what knocked my socks off about Kitchen Little the last time we were there is they probably had the best Rhode Island-style clam chowder that I've eaten anywhere. Now, this is in Mystic, Connecticut, but we're a stone's throw to Rhode Island.
Right.
And, Lynn, you know the difference between all the different types of clam
chowders? I know
chowders.
Manhattan is tomato, and I always think of New England as being essentially milk or cream.
Right,
a cream-based.
But I've never heard of Rhode Island.
Rhode Island's the best.
It's a third style that is it's clear. It's kind of steel gray clam broth with bits of potato and clams in it. It's very pure. I mean, not a lot of vegetables like you get in Manhattan chowder,
and none of the
rich creaminess that you get
it's just
up
briny
in New England.
And
it's very
oceanic.
Briny and bracing is what I would call it.
And they do this.
Yes, they do one of the best versions ever. You can also get a terrific hot lobster roll, which, like that style of chowder, originated on the southernmost coast of New England.
Huh. I think we figured out the last time we ate there that The entire restaurant is the size of a one-car garage in a suburban house. I mean, it's really tiny.
Oh, but it sounds
but somehow they managed to get that food out of the kitchen, and it's first rate.
And it sounds like the view is great at the same time. So
it's wonderful.
Hey, thanks, guys.
Bye, Lynn.
Bye, Lynn.
Stick shifts and safety belts. Bucket seats have all got to go when we're driving. In the car, it makes my baby seem so far. I need you here with me, not way over in a bucket seat. I need you to be here with me, not way over in a bucket seat.
Gene and Michael Stern are the authors of Two for the Road. Now, you know you can hear the Sterns here every week, but you can check out their food finds anytime you want. Just go to the website, splendidtable.org. An email came in from a listener complaining about how his fresh ginger would get moldy before he could use it up, and he wanted to know how to keep this from happening. Well, here are some thoughts. First of all, don't ever wash ginger before you store it. You want to keep it dry. You want to keep it cool. So that may have caused some of the mold. Another thing is a Chinese trick that I learned from a cook a long time ago. You peel and thin slice the ginger and you store it in rice wine or sherry. Now, sure, the flavor of the ginger is changed, but it's delicious. And the sherry is pretty swell, too. Another way of keeping ginger is to freeze it. Peel it, slice it, and freeze the rounds on a baking sheet. Then you can put them in a heavy plastic bag, and you can easily pull out whatever you need. Now, the ginger does get mushy in defrosting, but its taste isn't changed. By the way, one type of ginger that's worth stocking up on is what I call new ginger. Its skin is nearly transparent. It's got these dark red, small bud-like tips, and it's juicy and sharp and citrus-like. And it often appears in spring or early summer. I freeze a lot of it for summer drinks and for cooking. So keep an eye out for it.
The Parisians are so French, they sit on the metro. The Parisians are so French, not like me and you. I wanna go to Paris with you, just to see what the French boys do. Why don't you come to Paris with me, see the young Parisians?
Food authority Dori Greenspan is one of those consummate pros. She's written on her own and co-authored books with Julia Child, Danielle Belou, and French pastry deity Pierre Hermès. But my favorite book of Dori's is her very own. It's Baking from My Home to Yours. Dori, it's good to have you back.
Always nice to be back.
I've got a question. I want to talk about macaroons. Now, here's the question. I had my first macaroon in Paris 30 years ago, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't coconut, and it was sensational. Now, was it the ambience, or do the Parisians do special macaroons?
The Parisians do special. I mean, the ambience in Paris never hurts. It always adds something to whatever you're eating. But the Parisians have a macaroon that has become a cult sweet in the city. When you had it 30 years ago, it was just a good little pastry.
Right.
Now
right.
It's become something that people just cross the city to get the macaroon of the moment. It's gotten totally crazy. Ledgeray posts the flavors of the month.
That's outside the great their pastry door. Shop, right?
Great pastry shop, Ledgeray. Pierre Hermès, who is, you called him the deity of pastry. He's been called the Karl Lagerfeld of macaroons, Lagerfeld being Chanel's designer. He has truly set the standard for macaroons with flavors that, I mean, whoever would have thought? White truffle macaroon,
ooh.
Olive oil macaroon. His most famous, and it's copied absolutely everywhere all over the city, is the Isfahan. It's a rose macaroon filled with rose petal cream, lychees, and raspberries.
Holy cow!
The city has gone macaroon crazy.
Now, wait a minute. A filled macaroon. Does it all start with the non-coconut base, and is it almond?
It's totally non-coconut, and it's always almond. And it's so interesting. This summer, I was traveling in France, and I was in Saint-Emilion, which is best known for its wine.
Right, the Bordeaux region. Yeah.
Exactly. But among pastry people, really well known for their macaroons. And what they make has all the same ingredients as a Parisian macaroon, which is egg whites, which are, I guess, egg whites,
right.
Ground almonds, mm-hmm. sugar.
That's it.
Those are the that's it. And it's a completely different macaroon. It's like what a coconut macaroon would be like if it were almond. It's somewhat soft and flat. It's not light. And the difference between that macaroon, which you find all over France and you found for centuries.
It right.
was made in monasteries. The nuns, actually, in convents made these macaroons. The difference is that the Parisian macaroon, the egg whites are beaten into a meringue. And what you get is, let's call it a cookie, that has a little circlet that's kind of rough at the bottom. It's called the foot. And then it puffs up with a crust that's almost eggshell thin. And if you were to poke the crust inside, it's really soft and delicious, of course. And the macaroon, that little cookie is called the macaroon. And when you sandwich two of those cookies together, that's also called a macaroon. So it's a little confusing. But that's the Parisian macaroon.
So are these hard to make?
They're not the easiest to make, but they're not hard. What they require is patience, and you really have to follow the recipe. These are not things that you just kind of play around with because
yeah.
it's so interesting. What you do is you beat the egg whites until they're really firm, and then when you fold in the ground almonds and sugar, you beat down the air so that you get a batter that's not liquid, but it's kind of flowy in a way that you would never expect meringue to be.
Huh.
Actually, it's a really exciting pastry to make at home because for me, I mean, you know how much I love pastry, but I always think it's a thrill when you can recreate at home something that you loved that the professionals did. And this is doable.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Now I want the rose petals. Hey, Dory, thank you, dear.
It's been fun.
Dory Greenspan's author of Baking From My Home to Yours. Now, you can find her French macaroon recipe on the website, splendidtable.org. And while you're there, be sure to check out our other offerings, newsletters, podcasts, and the latest addition to our recipe box, Splendid Cheap Eats, a selection of some of the more inexpensive and inspiring recipes for you to make at home. Also at splendidtable.org is the Splendid Table store, where you can find products related to cooking and baking. Coming up, the richest medieval food literature in the world. Get back to the table with the art of the stir fry and how to make your own vinegar. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show about life's appetites. You know, some cookbooks just thrill me right down to my bones. And this is the case with a little book called Medieval Cuisine in the Islamic World, a concise history with 174 recipes. Look, I know I've got to get a life, but the reality is that I've been intrigued by what might be Arab influences in Italy way back in the 10th century. Well, this book explains so much. It tells of the Arab golden age of cooking and conquest sweeping across the Mediterranean. The book is by Lilia Zawawi, a professor of Arabic and Islamic studies in France. But it's an American scholar of Arab culinary history, Charles Perry, who wrote the book's foreword. He joins us today. Charles, welcome.
Thank you.
Charles, you know, it's not common that when we think medieval history, we think of Islamic influences. So what was happening in the Islamic world during that period?
Well, for one thing, there was a lot of cookbook writing. And that is very unique to the medieval Islamic world, that they were the first people who really cooked from cookbooks and wrote cookbooks. More than half the cookbooks from before the year 1300 are in Arabic.
Really? You mean half of the books on food in the entire world?
Yeah. More than in China, more than in Greece and Rome.
What was it about that period for them?
Well, apparently it was, it seems to me that it was the influence of the Persian court, because in the pre-Islamic Persian court had been full of gourmets, and they had habit of collecting their little personal recipe books.
Hmm.
And the caliphs continued this tradition. And in the 9th century, one scribe who had access to the books because he had family connections with the court,
mm-hmm.
published a lot of these recipes, published, by handwritten manuscript.
Right.
And I think that accustomed the Arabs to the idea of having recipes.
What was the position of food in the court of the Persians and then in the Arab world, which embraced that court? What was the position of food that people wrote about it?
Well, it was basically a way of establishing your social status. I mean, if you really knew the gourmet foods, well, just as in the modern world,
mm-hmm.
it showed that you were hip and you knew what was happening.
So where was this all coming from? Where in the Arab world was this coming from?
Well, originally from Baghdad, because that's where the court was, and there were a lot of recipes coming from there. And then there was a change of dynasty, and one of the members of the previous dynasty escaped to Spain, bringing a lot of the sophistication there. And Spain was an interesting place because they were not only Arabs and Spaniards, there were Persians, Berbers, and Jews. So
huh.
it was a very rich, complex kind of culinary arrangement. And it's not that well known. Most of the people who've been studying the medieval Arab food tradition, like me, for instance, have been concentrating on the East.
So tell me about the food.
Well, it wasn't very much like the cuisine of Lebanon or Syria today.
Uh-huh.
It was more like Moroccan food. It was very rich, complex stews flavored with nuts and rose water and all sorts of herbs. It was sort of like a cross between what we think of Middle Eastern food and Indian food.
Huh. And in Spain, was it the same way?
Well, Spain was a long way from Baghdad. And it was politically separated, so it became culturally separated and kind of went its own way, except in the case of desserts. The desserts are nearly the same throughout the medieval Arab world. And when you get to meat dishes, more differences. When you get to fish dishes, mm-hmm. immense differences.
Well, did you have just more seafood available in that Western Mediterranean area?
Oh, yeah. Spain and Tunisia have immense fisheries. In the Eastern books, I think there's only one particular variety of fish that's ever called for in a recipe. The rest just say fish or very often dried fish.
Charles, is there any truth to what I've heard that the Arabs had pasta before the Italians?
Yes, there were two sources of pasta. One was a Greek pasta called itria, which is kind of like a little soup noodle.
Uh-huh.
And then there was there were several kinds of pasta came out of Persia. One of them was just sort of like your ordinary, fettuccine kind of
right,
pasta.
Right, right.
And then another was a kind of ravioli. And that has spread far and wide in Asia. The Russian dish pelmeni, which is a sort of like a little ravioli and chicken broth, that came by way of Siberia to Russia from Persia.
Huh. So I think one of the things we don't realize is during that medieval period, the Arabs dominated almost all of the Mediterranean. Am I right in that?
Yeah. I mean, there was some back and forth, but their economies were much stronger. And so they did a lot of trade with Europe, though. I mean, they called for some recipes called for imported Italian cheese.
Huh. You know, I'm thinking that one of the things you hear in European food books is that some of the first books were medical handbooks. Was that a dominant factor in the cookbooks that came out of this Arab world?
It was a considerable factor, but not dominant, because medieval doctors didn't distinguish between food and medicine. And so there was often sort of like bogus medical advice connected with recipes in some books.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a medical encyclopedia which contained a lot of recipes, which were eagerly plagiarized by other cookbook writers because they were very well written, because they were, in effect, prescriptions.
Now, have any of these dishes survived today in the cuisines? Can we taste them today in cultures?
A few. They tend to be basic dishes like pilaf and couscous. There's a dish called mujaddara, which is basically rice and lentils cooked together. It can be very attractive if you put plenty of well-browned onions on top.
Mm-hmm.
But rather few. It's a very dicey business to try to see the connections between the medieval food and the modern food, because the medieval cookbooks were like most cookbooks until very recently. Namely, they recorded party foods. You didn't need the recipes for everyday foods because you'd already knew them. And they were fashionable dishes that people wanted to know about in, say, the 13th century. But when a dish is fashionable, that means it's eventually going to become unfashionable. And so the exact dishes, very few. The influences between that cuisine and the modern cuisine, you have to assume there is some. It's just very hard to trace.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
I traced one dish of fried eggplant down from the year, from sometime in the 9th century to the present, and it went through all sorts of changes. You would not recognize this as the same dish, except for the fact that it had the same name.
Well, Charles, thanks for talking with us.
Ah, I had a good time.
Charles Perry consulted on the translation and wrote the foreword to the book Medieval Cuisine in the Islamic World.
Trying something different today. Our managing producer and my co-author, Sally Swift, has left the control room to join me here at the mic for round two of our Back to the Table series. Sally, good to have you back.
Thank you. Thanks for letting me out again. I should explain what we're up to here, shouldn't I?
Yeah, I think you
should.
Okay.
Well, this is a series that we have been talking about doing to look at some of the more basic areas of cooking to hopefully inspire you to do a bit more cooking at home and to, quite frankly, cash in on Lynn's vast experience, which we rarely get to do since she's always doing the interviewing. So, Lynn, are you game to be in the hot seat today?
Yeah, I think I am.
Okay, I want to talk today about stir fry because I think that the thing that people don't know about you is that you started your career teaching Chinese food because you're one ornery Italian, right?
Well, you know, I wanted to get, let's face it, we all understand rebellion. I wanted to get as far away from Italian food.
Chinese was the way to go.
You know, but it's still one of my very favorite ways to eat.
Well, I mean, amazingly, you learn a lot when you study Chinese food.
Yeah, not only is this truly one of the handful of great cuisines on the planet, but it teaches you so much about understanding basic cooking
techniques. Okay, so let's talk about some of those things. I want you to go through the basic rules about the stir fry. And let's start in the prep area because that's
everything in Chinese cooking. There is a basic rhythm to a stir fry. Now, there'll be variations from recipe to recipe, but what we're about to talk about will apply across the board. The most important thing in Chinese cooking is you do not turn on the heat on the stove until you have prepped everything. So you go through the recipe, you cut everything as instructed. And now this is important. When a recipe says to cut something into half-inch dice or
squares, it means get out the ruler?
Well, if not get out the ruler, keep everything uniform.
Okay. So all the carrots are cut the same way, all the celery is cut the same way?
Because that's going to influence the timing. Now, if you're improvising your own stir fry, I do have a tip for you. Think about the vegetables that take longer to cook and the ones that cook more quickly.
Okay, so
contrast.
For instance,
long cooking would be carrots, short cooking would be a wedge of celery or piece of celery. Well, if you want to cook them together and do it in the same amount of time, cut the carrot small, cut the thing that cooks a long time smaller, cut the other thing larger.
It makes perfect sense.
Right.
Now, the other big key.
Oh, yeah. Everything must be dry.
Meaning your carrots need to be dry, meaning your onions need to be dry.
That's right.
Now, how do you go about doing that? So you would prep your carrots and they'd be in, say, a half-inch dice, and then what would you do with it?
I roll them up in a towel.
To get all of that moisture off.
I get all excess moisture off of it. Now, the only thing that isn't dry is if the recipe says take the chicken or whatever and dip it in egg white and roll it in rice flour.
Okay, so would you dry beef that wasn't marinated?
Absolutely.
Okay.
The meat, especially the meat. And this is really the thing that people forget about. And if you don't dry it, you don't stir fry, you steam. And you get this sort of wimpy, limp flavor. It's boiled. So just roll things up, get them dry, you're home free.
Okay, now there's one more thing. So we've got everything prepped, it's all ready to go, it's all dried off.
Right.
What's the next step?
The next step is knowing which oil to use.
Okay.
Now you want an oil with what's called a high burn point. So that means something like peanut oil, maybe soy oil, safflower oil. But you don't want, this is not the place for olive oil.
Okay.
Okay. Besides, you wouldn't use it anyway. Now, the other big rule is the wok is hot. The cold oil always goes into a hot wok. You do not put the oil in a cold wok and heat it up.
Which is exactly opposite of all the other cooking we do in our lives.
Exactly.
So you heat that wok until it's smoking, right?
Well, almost pretty hot. And you have everything lined up and ready to go.
Okay.
One other quick tip is if the recipe says add the soy sauce, the oyster sauce, and the wine together, put that all in one container when you do all of the prep.
So you can just do one big dump. Talk us through the rhythm of actually doing stir fry.
All right. You've got the wok hot, you swirl in the cold oil, it's going to heat up immediately, and then what you do is you usually flavor the oil with aromatics. It may be ginger, it may be garlic, it may be green
onion. So it's whatever
onion.
The recipe calls for of those three.
That's
ginger
right.
Or spices or whatever, but
exactly.
Not the liquids.
The next thing usually that happens is in goes the protein. It may be the tofu, it may be the meat, it may be the fish, and you stir fry it. You stir fry it for whatever amount of time. That's needed. It goes out of the wok. You wipe the wok mm-hmm. out, heat it again, add a bit more oil. Now you stir fry the vegetables. Now you add the liquids that will make the sauce. You boil that sauce with those vegetables that you've already stir fried. It's a matter of seconds
okay.
in some cases.
Okay.
The meat or the protein goes back in to warm up, and it's out of that wok.
And that is it.
That's done.
And that is the rhythm of a stir fry, and it never varies, no matter what recipe you're following.
Mm-mm.
That's the way it goes. Now, one last question. How do I buy a wok?
You want a rolled steel or a steel wok. You do not go near anything out of stainless steel, anything lined with enamel, anything
nonstick.
No nonstick, and not an electric one. It doesn't get hot enough.
Okay.
You want a flat-bottomed, something with a long wooden handle, and you want it to be made out of steel.
And they're inexpensive.
They're $25, and you've got a pan you can make soup in, you can steam in, you can stir fry in, and you can do everything else. And you
okay.
can bathe the baby in the blessed
thing. It's the perfect going away to college gift I found.
I still
have mine from college.
I'm still using the wok I bought 30 years ago.
Thank you very much, Lynn.
You are very welcome, Heather. You'll find our stir-fry recipe for hoisin lamb with cashews and snow peas on the website, splendidtable.org. You know, if you've ever mused over what to do with that glass of wine that you couldn't finish, I know it doesn't happen very often, but anyway, if you've ever wondered what to do with it, we have an idea. Kim Adams is one of the Gang of Pour. Now, this is seven Detroit wine crazies who created the Gang of Pour website. Kim has been making her own vinegar for 16 years. Hey, Kim, welcome.
Thank you so much.
So we want to make vinegar with our wine. How should we begin?
Well, there are a couple different ways. Some people would say that you could just take a bottle of wine, open it, let it sit in the corner, and eventually it will become vinegar.
Uh-huh.
Or you can try to get some mother of vinegar, which is basically a culture starter, if you will, and pour it into some red wine or white wine, and within 3 months or so, you will have some wonderful vinegar.
Could you just mix, you know, vinegar with that leftover wine? Would that eventually just sour the wine as well?
Well, you know, it might. I think the vinegar that you would buy commercially would need to have the mother in it. It would be unpasteurized, if you will.
Uh-huh, yeah.
So I don't know if regular standard commercial vinegar would do that.
What exactly is a mother?
Well, it is a bacteria that is used to convert wine or the alcohol in wine into vinegar. It allows it to ferment. And it occurs naturally in the air on grapes,
mm-hmm.
on fruit, and that sort of thing.
As I remember, it almost looks like a gelatinous disc. It sits on top of the liquid, right?
Yes, it does. It looks like on red wine vinegar, it would look like a slab of liver.
Oh, how attractive.
And white wine vinegar, it would be more like just a cellulose mass.
Uh-huh.
Some mothers are also like a greasy haze. I have several different crocks going, and some of them have the thick slab, and some just have this like greasy haze, mm-hmm. oily haze that floats on top.
You mentioned the crock. Now, should you do this in a bottle, in a crock? I gather it should have a wide mouth, right?
It needs a wide mouth because it needs to have air. It needs to breathe.
Okay, and then you can keep adding wine to that mother.
That's correct.
Can you mix wines? Can you do red and white together?
Well, a long time ago I read that you could not. Other articles I've read said that you can. I say you decide.
Mm-hmm.
I have not mixed white and reds together, but I've made white wine vinegar out of red wine mother, and that worked very well. In the beginning, of course, the white wine was quite pink, but then over time, as I kept adding white wine to it, it eventually changed to a more appropriate color.
What about adding sweeter wines? I'm thinking the Rieslings or the Chenin Blancs.
They make fabulous vinegar.
Oh, well, you know, that's logical. I just thought of it. We pay a fortune for some of those vinegars.
Right. In fact, I've been making some, I think the best vinegar I have are some of the sweeter fruit wines that we get here in Michigan. Cherry wines, raspberry wines. They're so intense. They're so sweet and fruit forward that they go very well on vanilla ice cream.
Oh, that sounds great.
I mean, they're just delicious.
So where would you get a mother?
Well, it's kind of hard to get mother now. I don't know why. I think that a lot of the online retail stores, they all seem to be sold out. But, you know, you could let your finger do the walking, try to find some hardware stores or beer and wine making supply stores. They may carry it. Or there's a lot of people on the internet that are now making vinegar. Maybe you could email them and ask them if they would send you some. Or try to just let the wine sit in a corner for several months and see if it makes its own.
And put it in something that has a wide mouth.
That's correct. And cover it with cheesecloth or a napkin so that it breathes and it keeps the bugs out.
One last question. You wait the 3 months or so. You're tasting this stuff to see if it's where you want it to be. You take it off. Now, do you just keep adding wine to that mother? I mean,
can you keep it
going indefinitely?
Yes. In fact, the main mother crock, if you will, that I have is 16 years old.
And from
that crock, I've made several other crocks.
So you just cut off some of the mother, put it in another crock, and you're off and running.
Or take some of the liquid out, because the liquid, the actual vinegar, is just impregnated with the acetobacter, the mother, if you will.
Right.
So you can pour a cup of that into a quart jar and then maybe fill it up halfway or three quarters of the way with some fresh wine, cover it up, and then just wait.
This is great. Hey, Kim, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Kim Adams is one of the seven wine lovers who created the Gang of Poor website. Now, for information on making your own vinegar, go to our website, splendidtable.org. Okay, it's time for this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question is, what is the latest trend in beverages in London? Now, we're going to have that answer in a moment, and we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Now, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls in a moment. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. But right now, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question was, what is the latest beverage trend in London? Well, it's absurdly high-priced bottled waters. Claridge's, that old line luxury hotel, now has a menu of 30 waters. You can have the rare privilege of spending $97 for a liter of water from the Tai Tapu volcano in New Zealand. Think of the ash that was filtered out. $42 buys you the 2,000-year-old Mahalo deep sea water from Hawaii. Do we really want old water? $57 buys you Berg mineral water. Now, and by the way, this is a quote from the Claridge menu. The pure taste of Canadian icebergs. I don't even want to go there. You can even pay for what's not there. Glaciana mineral water from Norway is described as having the least mineral content of them all. So if you remove all the minerals, what are you left with? It's time for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. Anything goes. Let's see who is up. We have Mina calling from Norco, California. Hey, Mina, what do you want to talk about?
Yes, ma'am. Good morning, Lynn. How are you?
I am very good. How can I help you?
Actually, you know what? It's such a funny story, you know. A friend of mine bought me a mango pie.
Oh.
And anything to do with mango, I love it.
You said that word, and I was immediately smelling that incredible aroma of mango. But go on, tell me the story.
That's the fruit it is, you know, such a beautiful fruit. Yes, and I asked her recipe, and she refused to give it to me. I said, well, that's fine. I have a lean guru. She knows everything.
tell me what the pie, what was the pie like?
It looked like a cream cheese pie.
Ah.
But only the thing, it had a mango feeling. And, you know, we get a ready-made graham cracker cookie crust, shell in the store.
Yes, yeah. And this was almost like a cream cheese cake, like a
That's
cheesecake?
It. Yes, but the filling was mango. And
oh.
A little bit of cardamom.
Oh, what a combination.
Yes.
All right, then this may be the way it's done. Mm. You can make a basic pudding. Now, that would be egg yolks, milk, sugar, a little bit of flour. If you look up pastry cream in any cookbook,
yes.
Okay, make a pastry cream and then puree your mangoes. And then what you would do is you've made that pastry cream. While it's still hot, you will have taken gelatin, clear gelatin, like Knox gelatin, that, you know, you sprinkle that gelatin powder over several tablespoons of cold water, let it sit for about 10 minutes. You're going to see the gelatin will expand.
Right.
Once that pastry cream is done, and usually that means if it has flour in it, you will have boiled it about 5 minutes, stirring constantly to make sure there's no raw flour taste, and it'll be very thick.
Right.
You will stir in the gelatin to melt it completely. Cool that down a little bit. And then stir in pureed mango.
Right.
And then if you wanted to, you could also fold into that a little bit of whipped cream. Pour that into the crust and let it set up in the refrigerator. Alternatively, there's another thing you could do to make it lighter, which is that you could use that gelatin, add the gelatin to the whipped cream. Okay, melt it down in a little bit of water so it's completely melted. There's no granular quality to it. Add that to the cream. Whip the cream with some vanilla and cardamom. I would flavor the base with the cardamom, whether it's the pastry cream or the whipped cream. Okay,
and then
fold in the pulp, and you'll get like a mango cream.
Yes,
that will gel up in the refrigerator. The pastry cream is going to be a heavier, deeper, bigger flavored, but not super delicate pie. The other one's going to be a tad more delicate, but it's trickier to do.
Right.
But that would be the way you would do it. And I think it would be I would give a little shot of lime in there. And if you think it's not sweet enough when you before you put it in the fridge, add a little bit of sugar. You know, if your mango for some reason.
Just regular sugar.
Yeah. But to taste. Just do it to taste. But that's how I would do it. And I think it's very ungenerous of someone to bring you something delicious and not share the recipe. I'm sorry. That's very...
No, you know, Lynn, it has a story behind it. I did not tell you that.
Oh, I see. There's a little issue, shall we say, going on here?
Yes. You know what happened? I had made lamb curry. And when she came, she bought this mango pie. Well, she asked me recipe for the lamb curry, which I gave it to her. A couple of weeks later, she called me, and it did not turn out to be what she tasted at my home. And I said, look, Cynthia, I had given you exactly how I made it. She said, no, you were holding it back. And therefore, I'm not going to give you a mango recipe.
Oh, dear. Well, I don't think I'll get in the middle of this one, but try either approach for the mango pie. I think you're going to love it.
Yes.
And if you want to send the lamb curry recipe this way, it would be most welcome, and no one will complain on this end.
I surely will do that.
Thank you. I appreciate it. You take care.
Thank you so much.
You are welcome. Goodbye. I love it. I just love it. You can call us at 800-537-5252. Let's see. Who's up next? We have got Keith calling from Charlotte, North Carolina. Keith, what do you want to talk about?
Yes. Well, the first thing I want to talk about is Hey, nice to meet you. I listen to your show all the time, and of course I found out new ways to cook everything.
Well, thank you. Thank you.
And I wanted to find out, one of my friends work in the police department late at night, uh-huh. and he always told me I can cook inside of a fireplace.
Ah, yeah.
Yeah, but the first time I did it, I just ruined a pretty nice piece of meat.
What happened? It got burned?
Well, it got burned all over.
It didn't cook.
Yeah, it was nasty.
Did you wrap it in foil?
Yeah, I wrapped it in foil, and like you told me to go ahead and just bury it in the coals. But the problem of it is that I have a fireplace insert.
So
I don't know if it gets too hot or whatever.
But. Well, it does get pretty hot. But the other part of it is, let me back up for a second. First of all, there's a book that is all about cooking with fire. You know, cooking in your fireplace, and it would apply to what you have. Because I have something similar. I have a fireplace insert, and I've tried this. It's called, I think, The Magic of Fire. It came out several years ago, and it's also on our website. I love this book because, first of all, it illustrates everything. And secondly, this guy who wrote this book takes you by the hand as though you've never done it before, because let's face it, most of us never have, and just walks you through it. And what I did from the book that really worked for me was I would let the fire burn until you had about 3 or 4 inches of, you know, hot embers. And, you know, that happens in an evening, right? Where you yeah. get that. And then what I do is I would wrap vegetables, like I would wrap onions. I would wrap up scrubbed beets. When I was really rolling money, I would wrap up artichokes. But you get the idea. Carrots, parsnips. I would scrub them. I might season them even. But I would just wrap them in foil and bury them in those coals for about an hour. And it was fabulous. Now, I've not done that with meat. Whenever I've cooked meat in the fire, I've done it over those coals, not buried into the coals. Because I'd love to know more about what your friend did, because to me it would seem that it would just be too hot. I would have the problem you would have with it. You know what I would do, though? Why don't you try it with burgers? And a burger is going to be no more than maybe an inch thick. And you don't want a burger rare because, you know, it can be very tricky. But I would wrap it in a couple of layers of foil, season it any way you want, and I would put it in the coals. But I'd put it sort of near the top so that you can be flipping it with tongs, so that the bottom of the burger is where it's real hot in the coals and the top is, you know, just exposed to the air. And then I would give it maybe on each side, let's say 5 to 8 minutes, pull it out, let it cool a little, open it up, cut into the burger and see where you are. If it's underdone, you can put it back in and then you'll find out timing, because I think timing is a big part of this. But I would only fool around with some inexpensive hamburger meat to see if you can do it in the coals. But try the vegetables. They're really delicious. Just forget about them for about an hour or so.
Would I be able to do chicken the same way?
I wouldn't try chicken until you had conquered something like, you know, something simple. A cheap cut of steak. No, because chicken really has to be cooked through. And it requires a long-term commitment to heat and heat control. It's much trickier than something that you can cook fast, like a piece of inexpensive steak. So don't invest a lot in the beginning. Okay. And good luck, Keith.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
You take care. Bye. You can reach us anytime, day or night, at 800-537-5252. Henry Petrosky is a man who is fascinated by function, design, and objects we tend to ignore. Now, there's some logic to this because he is the Alexander S. Vesic Professor of Civil Engineering and a Professor of History at Duke University. Now, he's written about the bookshelf, about the pencil, and his focus is moving to more and more minute objects. His new book is The Toothpick, Technology and Culture. Professor Petrosky, welcome.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
So you have to tell me, what is so alluring about a toothpick?
Well, it's a very simple object. I write about design, and I wanted to write about the simplest thing I could think of. Originally, it was to be a chapter in another book, but I couldn't find enough information to make up a chapter, so I put it aside. But it kept nagging at me that there was an interesting story there. And sure enough, when I had some time to get back to it, I did find an interesting story, or two or three.
So what is its significance?
Well, I think its significance is that it's one of the oldest tools that people have used. It dates back millions of years, literally. It also it's a very controversial object as far as society and culture is concerned. There are people who swear by toothpicks in some of the olden times, prior times. Some of the people in the highest ranks of society used toothpicks with abandon and used them very publicly, and it was just the thing to do. It was good dental hygiene, a lot better than letting your teeth rot away, because there really was no other tool to clean the teeth but a toothpick.
You spend a lot of time in the book talking about the toothpick in America, and I'm wondering, could you give us sort of the highlights of the history of this thing in our own country?
Yes, that's actually the heart of the book. There was a fellow named Charles Forster who was a New Englander, Boston area, and he was working in Brazil in the mid-19th century, and he saw the natives down there using toothpicks that they had carved themselves. And he noticed that these natives had beautiful white teeth. So Forster got the idea that he was going to manufacture wooden toothpicks by machine and do it so successfully that he would export them to South America and around the world. He actually did achieve his goal, but it took a while. It took about 40 years, in fact. The first thing he had to do was figure out how to make the toothpicks by machine. That took quite a bit of doing, and he had to rely on a lot of other inventors because he himself was not much of an inventor. Then he had to figure out how to sell them because people weren't used to spending money on something that was so common and disposable. So he came up with some rather clever schemes. One in particular was he hired some, actually Harvard students is the way the story goes, and paid them to go and eat at a restaurant and afterwards demand toothpicks, these new wooden kind that are machine-made, never touched by human hands, so they were hygienic. The restaurant manager said, well, we don't carry those things. I don't know anybody who carries those things. And the students walked out in a huff and said, well, we'll never visit this establishment again. Now, what should happen the next day but Charles Forster, the manufacturer, shows up peddling his toothpicks, and, of course, how could the restaurant manager refuse? So in the 1870s and 80s, it became very, very fashionable for people of the highest ranks of society to walk around with wooden toothpicks in their mouth, and it signified that you had a good meal at a good restaurant.
Well, isn't it dangerous walking around with a toothpick in your mouth?
Oh, yes. I have a whole chapter on the dangers of using a toothpick. There was a woman who was walking around with a toothpick in her mouth, and her previous husband saw her and rushed up to her and tried to give her a kiss and actually poked his eye out. In fact, the toothpick went to his brain and eventually he died.
What about toothpick etiquette as of today? Is it proper to use a toothpick in public?
Well, that depends on where you are. In America, it's generally frowned upon, but the etiquette watchers often hedge because it's not totally absolutely clear. In other societies, it's quite common. I was in Scandinavia year or so ago, and in Sweden, where we were, they commonly set a little bowl of toothpicks on the table next to the salt and condiments.
Yeah, yeah.
And after dinner, somebody picked one up and started using it, and then some others picked one. And after a while, just about everybody was using a toothpick. Now, these are people that I have never seen use a toothpick in the United States, but there they felt, I think, that they were given permission because they were right there on the table.
Professor Petrosky, thanks for talking with us.
Oh, well, thank you. I enjoyed it very much.
Professor Henry Petrosky is author of The Toothpick, Technology and Culture. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for joining us. Remember, you can call us anytime. The number is 800-537-5252. Well, until next time, let me leave you with this quote from Anonymous. A samurai, even when he has not eaten, uses his toothpick.
Splendid Table is produced by American Public Media and supported in part by Las Vegas. Vegas Uncorked brings chefs from around the world to town May 7th through 10th. You can see them in firsthand cooking demonstrations and taste their creations at parties at Vegas resorts and restaurants. VegasUncorked.com. Information on everything you heard here today can be found on our website, splendidtable.org. Not only will you find our newsletter and podcasts, you'll find information on our book, How to Eat Supper, and you can find it all, you know where, splendidtable.org. Also at splendidtable.org is the Splendid Tables store, where you can find products related to cooking and baking. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Andrew Schumacher and Judy Boudreau. Our technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Judy Graham and Jeff Harkness. Our managing producer is Sally Swift. Have a great week. Please join us next time, and thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto-Casper.
American Public Media.